women and the family, both in the past and in the present. I think for a long time, we all assumed that the family was somehow an institution that had remained exactly the same forever and ever from the very days when the apes came down out of the trees. I think we're a little more sophisticated about that today and realize that the institution of the family, like all the other institutions of our society, has changed over time and in some very significant ways. And so to begin our discussion of this evening, I'd like to introduce to you Professor Alan Grebner from the College of St. Catherine. Professor Grebner teaches women's history, among other things, at St. Catherine's, and he will speak to us this evening on the changing roles of the changing structures and functions of the family and the role of married women within the family over the past century. Professor Grebner.
I think I was just pointing out, by picking up on what Gretchen has mentioned, that to talk about changes in the family, to talk about the family having a history, is a very explosive kind of thing, ideologically, because it means that especially those who opt for a conservative way of looking at society are on very shaky grounds. It means, in the end, that even the family changes over time, and that means, in the end, that everything changes over time, and you haven't got much of a base to work with, something to hang on to. But that aside, my assignment is to talk about married women in the last 100 years, and one elementary but important generalization that one can make about married women in the last 100 years is that there are more and more of them. And I mean that, in several senses. Obviously, there would be more married women as the population increases, but I'm thinking on somewhat more sophisticated grounds than that. For example, if one looks at all the women who were born in specific years, which in demography is known as a cohort, and concentrate on the women born in 1870, and then say 1890, and then say 1920, the women in the last, of course, would still be alive, many of them, and then separate them, that is, limit yourself to a typical 100,000 of those women. If you're talking about those born in 1870, of that 100,000 born in that year, 30,000 would be dead before they're age 20. If you go to 1890, those born in 1890, still, 26,000 of them would be dead before they've reached age 20. If you go to 1920, though, of 100,000 women born in that year, only 10,000 would be dead by age 20. Of course, I can say only and toss around figures glibly, but still, I hope even without a blackboard, you can see that's a drop to a third. In other words, there are more women in the last cohort, those born in 1920, who are eligible for marriage, in a very elementary sense of still being alive, which is an important qualification. And that points to a gradual movement in the past 100 years toward an increasingly standardized pattern for married women. If one looks at these groups of women born in specific years that you separate by 20 years or so, say 1850, 1870, 1890, 1900, 1920, something like that, at each point in time, for each group, it's more likely that a woman would survive to age 20 than that she would die. It's more likely that of those who did survive to age 20, that they would marry than that they would remain single. Having married, it's more likely that they would become mothers than they would remain childless. And having become mothers, it was more likely that they would be alive and not be widowed at age 55 than that they would be dead or widowed by age 55. And those statements get truer the closer one gets to the present. Let me attach some statistics to that. About 1/5 of those who were born in 1870 got married, had children, and lived past age 55 without being widowed. That's not very many, really. 20% is all that will fit all of those qualifications, that at age 55 they're still alive with their children and their husbands are still alive. Fairly conservative. By 1920, about 2/3 of the women born then could fit those qualifications. That is, they had lived past 20, they'd gotten married, they had children, and their husbands were still alive. So the relevant figures are 1/5 over against 2/3, a pretty substantial shift in that period of time. To go back to my generalization then, there's been increasing uniformity in life patterns, the closer one gets to the present, and the pattern of being married, having children, and living on well into life is the norm. Of course, when one talks about women with children, that can imply quite a few and varied experiences, varying according to the number of children you're talking about. I was once moved to investigate the life of my own great-grandmother, someone about whom I originally knew rather little, since I had never met her. She was married to a history professor, by the way, in 1873. In other words, almost falling in terms of her marriage within the chronological limits of the last 100 years. She was 22 when she was married. She had her first child when she was 25, and I suspect the reason for that gap is that there was a miscarriage, although I don't have evidence for it. She went on from that point to have 10 more children, the last when she was aged 45. In other words, for 23 years, she was pregnant about 2/5 of the time. And she was 63 before her last child reached age 18. Now, it seems pretty clear to me that childbearing and child-rearing were lifelong preoccupations for her. There was no other, demographically, there's no other choice. And it seems equally obvious to me that a woman with 8 or, say, 12 children has different options open to her than a woman, say, with 2 children, or with none at all. Maybe I don't need to belabor that point any further, because it seems to me to stand like a great rock in the middle of the path, ready to bark the shins at anyone who ignores it while rushing to get close to the present. It's not something, of course, that one has to reckon with if you're talking about the present, except, of course, for specific subcultures in our society, where at least until recently, large numbers of children were still being born. But for most Americans, in the course of the late 19th century, and then naturally on into the 20th century, millions of women, married women, took steps of the exact nature one can only guess to limit the number of births. My contention is that in doing so, they were taking control of their own lives in very significant ways. Again, let me attach some numbers here to try and make the point. If one looks at a gross birth rate per white birth rate per 1,000 population, and I choose that only because the statistics are readily available and they seem fairly certain, in 1870, the birth rate is about 38 per 1,000. By 1900, it's down to 30. It falls further in the Depression. In fact, it falls to about 17, then rises in the 1960s, fortunately, for the system of education. You get that nice bulge to keep us all in business. And then, of course, as you're well aware, it falls drastically, beginning about in the mid-60s, to the present time, when it's well below 20, and I think it's below 17. In other words, it's lower than it has ever been in our society. Now, what I'm alleging is that women, married women, have been affected in very basic ways by those very elementary figures. But I still would have to admit that whether one had many children or few, for the great majority of married women, up until recently, in the last 100 years or so, having children, any number of children, meant necessarily keeping house, as most of their activities were carried on in the home to keep it running smoothly, or at least to keep it running. So it seems to me one ought to say something about that aspect of a woman's life. And my thrust here is that, until recently, keeping house involved an enormous amount of work, and I certainly don't denigrate the amount that it still involves, but I'm talking in relative terms here. I suppose that one ought to take notice of improvements like the treadle-operated sewing machine or the cast-iron stove about mid-19th century. But that's a pretty short list, and one can't go very far beyond it for most of the 19th century. In other words, until one gets well into the 20th century, if one talks about keeping house, things are pretty grim. It isn't terribly hard to reproduce the situation, by the way. If you're curious about this and haven't done it already, go down to Ramsey House and ignore all of those nice front rooms and bury yourself back in the kitchen. Not as a visitor, just poking around, but imagine yourself being there and working there the way you worked at home. If you don't have time for that, just go home tonight or any other night and go into your own kitchen and perform a few simple things. First of all, you ought to turn off all the electricity. And then while you're at it, you also ought to turn off the high-volume thermostatically controlled hot water heater. The absence of electricity, of course, knocks out the vacuum cleaner. It also ought to knock out the washer and dryer. And you would have, one step would be a little bit more difficult because you ought to rig up some Rube Goldberg kind of device that would blow steadily, at least during the winter, blow steadily a light film of dust and coal particles throughout the house to complete things fully. And then as the final part of the experiment, you ought to go down to the grocery store. First of all, unload all of your shelves, and then go down to the grocery store and buy only staples in bulk and canned goods. And buying 6 boxes of Bisquick and half a dozen TV dinners doesn't count as buying in bulk. Now, this is a situation that is not significantly altered for the majority of married women until really the 1920s. And for a great many women, especially in rural districts for poor women, it isn't altered until much later than that. That is, what I'm trying to say is that it would be possible, had we all the time in the world, to go through and cite the first date at which major conveniences come on the market. But what one has to remember is that millions of women never see those conveniences for decades after they're first introduced. So there's a pronounced lag, much more so, I think, than we've gotten used to more recently. As late as 1900, millions of lower-class women, living in cities, mind you, had to carry by hand all the water that they used in from an outside pump, use it inside the house, and when it was used up, carry it back out to a sewer outside, everything coming in on foot. Now, it's true that until the first quarter of the century or so, maids and cooks were taken for granted at least by middle-class women, including women whose descendants now would be quite shocked to have a professional cook or a paid cook in the kitchen and would feel really that they ought to clean up a bit before a cleaning lady came in. But still, it may also be true that standards are higher today than they were, although I don't think that's something susceptible to ready proof. Nevertheless, would still want to argue that the electric kitchen, laundry room, central air conditioning, central heating, plus the services that are now purchasable outside the home, vastly alter the amount of work that's necessary to be done by typical married women. And this means, in turn, that their lives are different. They're different. I'm not necessarily saying they're easier. I suspect that were we in a different kind of format, at least one of you would raise the point that women today are just as busy as their grandmothers because many of them are working. At which point I would pull the typical professorial trick and say, I'm very happy that you said that because that, in fact, is my next point. It gets us to the matter of gainful employment. I could, I think, pretty easily put you even more soundly to sleep by a kind of lullaby of statistics on labor force participation over the last century. I'm not sure what the appropriate tune for the statistics would be. Maybe, for married women, it would be Rockabye Baby. I think that would probably be the appropriate one, because most married women are outside the labor force for the 19th and early 20th century. In 1890, perhaps 1/8 of all women who worked were married. Very low percentage. If you want to put it another way, only about 5% of all married women were working as of 1890. Another non-statistical way of saying this is that usually if a married woman worked, it meant that something was wrong. It meant that she had an incapacitated husband or no husband. It meant that she belonged to an ethnic minority, or it meant that she belonged to the lower class. A major exception to this would be farming, although that, of course, is something that involves a steadily shrinking percentage of the population. Now, this relative absence of married women from the labor force continues decade after decade in the 19th century and into the 20th century, even though the number of single women working rises steadily. The great shift for married women comes after World War II. Specifically, in 1940, only about 17% of all married women were working. By 1965, that percentage is up around 35%. It doubled. And the most recent shifts within this movement is the increasing incidence not only of married women working, but of mothers working, and then more recently, mothers with young children. What I've described, or at least alluded to, then, is the rise, and maybe the beginning of the fall, of a three-stage work cycle, two stages of work divided, interrupted by childbearing, not as previously terminated by marriage. Again, I think my basic point is that even the conservative employment pattern that most married women would take for granted today is a relatively new development. Probably, not certainly. One of the reasons that more married women are returning, and since World War II have returned to gainful employment, is that more jobs are available that, superficially at least, are pleasant in somewhat decent surroundings. Partly this is because of shifts in the economy, partly shifts in technology, and partly, I think, is the factor of women's education. And that's another point I want to mention. We're up to number 4, I guess, if you're counting. I'm particularly interested in higher education in this regard. The first women's college was not founded until the 1860s, so it barely falls outside of our chronological limits. But it's significant that when it was founded, Harvard was then about 200 years old. That is rather typical. In fact, it's certainly typical in the Twin Cities. The College of St. Catherine is the baby sister of the cooperating colleges in St. Paul. Furthermore, whether they came from a women's college or from co-educational institutions, the number of women graduates, women BAs, was extremely small. In 1870, in the whole country, 1,400 women were granted bachelor's degrees. Now, the University of Minnesota does more than that in a single term, let alone the whole country. We could follow this through. So 1870 is 1,400. To make a big jump, 1930 is 50,000. And 1960 is 120,000. Of course, the total population is growing in the same period, so you need some kind of a base. Maybe another way of putting it is that in 1900, only one woman out of 7,000 received a bachelor's degree. By 1970, it's about one woman out of... I might have mixed that up. Did I say one out of 7,000 in 1900? By 1970, it's roughly one out of 700. You get a drastic shift. And much of that comes since about 1940, percentage steadily increasing. Now, necessarily changed by higher education. There's the old Mohammedan proverb. You may have heard that an ass may go to Mecca, but as an ass shall return. Nevertheless, it does seem to me that higher education opens options to women that are not otherwise, well, it opens options to anyone that are not otherwise open, particularly if one's talking about professions. I can leave aside the important question of which professions are chosen. That's another question. All I'd like to point out to here is that a person with the option for respected and lucrative gainful employment is in a different position than one without that option, and that the number of persons with that option, the number of women with that option, was, what's the stock market phrase, sharply higher as the 20th century proceeds. So let me try and summarize so far. I'm saying, for one thing, that on a demographic base, married women today are in a substantially different position than they were 100 years ago. And maybe I can take the time to talk about averages at a specific point in time. If you look at two dates, 1890, say, and, well, let's say 1970, and you look at the average age of women doing certain things, it comes out roughly like this. The woman in 1890 left school for the last time at age 14. By 1970, it isn't until 18. She got married in 1890 at age 22. It's pretty close to that, perhaps a little lower by 1970. She had her first child at age 25 in 1890, but at age 21 in 1970. She had her last child at age 32 in 1890, but at 26 in 1970. Her husband died when she was 53 in 1890, when she was 64 in 1970. And she died in 68, at age 68 in 1890, at age 78 in 1970. In other words, what you've got is a substantial lengthening of the period between the birth of the last child, and hence the date at which the last child left home, and her own death, the mother's own death. So that's one generalization, the demographic base. The other is recapitulation of the four things I was mentioning. In terms of the number of children that they bear, in terms of the work they do both inside and outside the home, in terms of education, recent women have lived substantially, and are living substantially different lives. Now, the lessons I draw from this are that the current feminist movement should be no surprise at all, because circumstances are just so different. Nor is it surprising to me at all that feminism should have been so warmly received, especially by married, middle-class women. The real militants, in my experience, as far as feminism are concerned, the real militants are not undergraduate women on college campuses. College women are too young and have been too well socialized. 18 years of it is quite enough to make them quite conservative in most regards. And it's a real chore to try and figure out how you can interrupt that. Gretchen is engaged in that kind of a chore at St. Olaf, and on one hand I envy her, and on the other hand it would add to gray hair pretty fast, I think. What seems to me to demand an explanation then is not the feminist movement, what gets the attention usually, but rather the women who have resisted feminism, who seize on Broadburn, which of course never occurred, to speak in deprecatory terms about those radical women, who ridicule efforts to change the socialization of children, who get involved in fighting the ERA. Those are the women, it seems to me, that in light of the shifts that have occurred, are the more interesting ones, because somehow you have to account for them bucking a trend. And to do that, I think we'd need another night or so, because it seems to me then you're into not the kinds of things that I've been talking about women so far, but rather ideas about women. Ideas that, as I'm sure you know, are curious things, because they tend to have a life of their own, irrespective of outside external reality. But ideas, in any event, that are strong enough that they mean that while to oversimplify with all those risks to make a point, that while we are in the 20th century, in terms of a lot of external facts about the women's lives, we're really still in the 19th century, in many respects, when one talks about ideas of women. And I think rather than being unfair and using much more of my time, I'll quit there, and perhaps in later discussion we can come back to that if you like. Thank you.
Trying to
ethnicity, color, handicap, and possibly soon with fictional, whatever that means, purposes. But these laws were established intended, hopefully, that all families may survive. By the segregated suggestion of women and minorities, psychologically, every person thinks white. And I find that to be true in my own business setting. I'm forever saying, when you say women, you're talking about me. Okay, and I say this to my white female counterparts, too. And when you say women, when you go around to talk with the departments about reaching parity, make sure when you say women, and we have these many jobs for women, that you're including all women. Is there more jobs up there? The classification of black women in minorities tends to skip the black woman on the right of female classification. And unfortunately, she is not viewed as female sexually or physically, not even thought about in that realm. She's not, probably not thought about at all. I'm taking a course over the university and wordplay. And sometimes you know how it is, you can look at people and you turn your eyes away, but you can also pretend that person is a post and just pass out on dying. And black women is insisting that they not be viewed as a post, that they're indeed female. She stagnates evidently in that, from what I can view in that generalized category, considered to be by many, quote unquote, piece of pie, unquote. And that's where all this, seemingly what they call misfits or unwanted, are thrown. It adds on to the mistrust of cause and frustration among minority groups today. And when I say minority groups, I'm talking about the Oriental, the Native Americans, blacks, and Spanish third persons, especially those like the Puerto Ricans, disadvantaged persons who have as hard times as we do seeking employment. These disheartened could be in the workforce members, it seems, and not be fitting a higher percentage of jobs that companies, the Orientals who must compete within that one piece of pie. See, when they threw all these groups in together, the pie didn't spread. Maybe with women entering the competitive role of playing with white male, hopefully this will broaden the slice of pie. Otherwise, they all ghettoize in that pie and just cause some more unrest and unhappiness among the minority group of women and all minority groups. Unfortunately, most black working men and women in Minnesota are not accepting the complete trust that the white female cry for liberation for women include them, no matter what you say about it. They think that when you talk about equal opportunity, will be accomplished for women by way of, black women view it as black women riding onto the apron string of the laws created for minorities. And I'm sure many of you have heard this. And that similar and equal rights will be obtained for minorities is just another way of bringing them along and having them agree with the movement, more or less, and not cause problems. It is viewed by most black women in Minnesota as, quote, another white maternalistic gesture. To see the step attached behind the phrase, quote, women and minority, is to be placed in lowest priority in the still competitive job market, to say the least about classified as being less than female. This placed them even more in a defensive position, so therefore it accounts for their not joining as readily as women may think they should join. If the liberation movement accomplished nothing else than black women, it would have certainly opened up their minds even more. Black women are more self-aware now, assured that they must be out fighting to survive or they die, and so will their family. And they're determined that they can't sit back and depend on black men to rescue them. Therefore, black women are directing attention to basic barriers problems that hinder them. They're beginning to question the reliability of the Minnesota state employment statistics. They're concerned about the great number of unemployed blacks and other minorities not being counted among the workforce statistics in Minnesota. We have lost interest in responding to ads, whatever few they are now, those who have given up looking for, quote, forever unavailable, unquote, opportunities. These disheartened could be in the workforce members, it seems, are not benefiting a higher percentage of jobs that companies and the education system must establish as parity goals to be reached in all jobs categories. A good project for some of you women, if you want something to do, would be to try to do something about finding out how many women are minorities and are minorities are not being counted who could be working. I understand this is being done on a national level, but I was told that it was not being done on the local level, a Twin Cities level, or even a state level here. But despite loopholes designed to retard the growth of black women in Minnesota and in the nation as a whole, many black women slipped through the loophole and have liberated themselves and are progressing. They are determined not to allow any group, including the black male, and I keep emphasizing this on purpose, to render them guilty of suppression and oppression. Nor will they allow themselves to be molded into complicity in exchange for lack of fair consideration. Hard times, as always, affects black families more and will further enhance more aggressiveness in black women due to the fact that many are heads of household, and black head is usually first to be fired, with some companies especially. Fortunately, black women are more aware of society ills due to their historical occupational roles. They are more able than either minority to cope with American society, not only due to their innate discerning ability, but also due to long, continuous historical exposure to the private life and habit of the white race, both male and female. She benefits, too, due to her endowed knowledge and insurmountable fortitude to withstand and overcome obstacles. On the positive side, there's some notable black women. And I won't go down the list as I intended. From a national level, I'll just name a few. You all remember the late Mary McGloyd Bethune. She was founder of Bethune-Cookman College and founder of the National Council of Negro Women. Ida B. Wells Barnett, an educator and a journalist, was a leader of numerous anti-lynching crusades and a founding member of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. A lot of black people don't like that, colored people, anymore, but it is also termed as NAACP. Madam C.J. Walker, she was the first black female millionaire. She was born in the swamps of Delta, Louisiana, and became the first black millionaire way back in those days. She was due to her successful manufacturing of hair products and cosmetics. No matter what the crises are economically, women do still tend to take care of the stomach and the hair. Frances E.W. Harper, the first black woman to publish a novel and a prominent member of the early women's rights movement, she noted that when it came to a question of race, she let the lesser question of sex go. Of course, all of you know of Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman, and of course, you've heard of Phyllis Wheatley Community Center. It was named for a former slave brought to this country from Boston and taught to read. And that was a detriment, evidently, when slaves began to read. And she became a poet at the age of 13. Excuse me. There are many, many other women who made it despite barriers. The denying of right inspired and fortified black women politically also. And when I say that, I can think of such persons as Barbara Jordan. She is one of the members of the House of Representatives, and other such members as Curtis Collins, Yvonne Burke, Sherry Chisholm. Such persons have served as innovators for current and for position in 1968, women represented only 7%, when I say women, I'm talking about all women, of physicians, 9% of scientists, and 3% of lawyers. This was taken from Women's Bureau in 1971. Black women have been reluctant to join the women's liberation movement, suspecting that the working middle-income, non-working, suburban, and college-educated white activists who generally have the feminist drive and are oriented toward white girls. And whether this is true or not, this is what the thinking is. The part black women should play is a controversial topic among black persons, male and female. She confirms that many black women have felt guilty for even thinking of joining their white counterpart in a place of female solidarity against patterns of sexist prejudice, while black male continue to be the victims of massive discrimination and injustice.
Separate even wage deprivation. Taken together, these data indicates that black women, who often have the same desperate need for employment,
to speak to you under the aegis of the AUW. None of us, as individuals, can speak for all men or all women, for their wide divergencies of views amongst persons of both sexes. The material I present to you, however, comes from scholars of both sexes, who tend to agree on certain fundamental aspects of these problems. As with the race issue in this country, I do not believe it's a matter of strictly black versus white, or male versus female, but those who believe in equality for all persons versus those who apparently do not believe in such equality. Yeah, particularly privileged to speak as a person to you, I have some credentials, having been a long time legal and Borders husband, and being one of those rare males who is a member of the National Organization of Women, and often finding myself more feminist than many of my women friends. So I shall try to, at least, to speak to some of you. First, a few comments about the nature of social change, institutional change, and focus on the family, not meaning marriage necessarily, but the relationship between the sexes and what we've had as traditional marriage and family. Family changes because of both internal and external forces. A major shift in the economic base of the American family has brought a number of changes, one of them being changes in family size, which Dr. Gribner alluded to. Alterations in religious attitudes have made divorce more acceptable, as well as contraception and many other things. Social Security provisions and other New Deal acts altered family members' sense of responsibility and their financial commitment to each other. And thus we see that change in one institution spurs change in others, in the sense the institutions are interrelated as a family. The internal changes in the family, however, have been primarily in response to external forces. The family is fairly weak as an individual institution to oppose the major economic, political, and other forces in our society, principally those brought about by technology. Our American family has changed from a predominantly agricultural, rural, producing unit to predominantly an industrial, urban, consuming unit, in which one of the few products still manufactured in the home are ice cubes. Of the three meals a day, only breakfast is fully stayed at home, increasing eating out for lunch and eating out for meals at dinner. A few comments about social change in regard to the impact of democratic philosophy. At least in our society, there has been a gradual democratization of our civic life in many particulars. There's also, parenthetically, I'm concerned with some of us, authoritarian development in our society when we get into CIA and all other things, but in this particular stream, there's been a democratization of our civic life. From an American constitution which focused on white, male, adult property owners as citizens, our laws over time have gradually been changed to grant legal rights of citizenship to blacks and Native Americans, and to non-holders of property, and more recently to younger members of our society, age 18. Women have been granted some of these rights, but since the Supreme Court has yet to apply the 14th Amendment to the Constitution to women, they still lack full equality for the law. The Equal Rights Amendment is directed to correct that important discrepancy. We are seeing the implications of democratic philosophy at work in its application more consistently and more thoroughly to our societal arrangements of power and privilege. Well, obviously, as has already been indicated, there remain wide, wide gaps between the reality and the ideal in this racist, sexist society, which justice, power, and privilege are also unequally distributed by economic class position. A democratic philosophy fully implemented would provide any citizen an optimum opportunity to develop their own lives and talents without restrictions by race, sex, or other extraneous characteristics. To this extent, or in this context, men and women, husbands and wives, boys and girls, would be equally provided the same range of options for their lives, which to choose, and guaranteed the same civic rights and opportunities. Living would be associative, with each pair or household group permitted to devise their own role relationships without formal coercion. Children would be optional, not produced through a sense of duty. Husbands and wives would be equal. That does not mean identical. There would be independence from parents after marriage. Persons would be guided in their own right, and not as adjuncts to someone else. The comment of Lucy Stone, you may recall, who in 1885 married Henry Blackwell, said, "My name is a symbol of my identity and must not be lost." A wholeness of personality is being sought by many. A significant revolution is in the making and will take time. The defeat of ERA in New York and New Jersey last week indicates the strength of the traditions and opposition that yet remain. Esther Peterson, a judge, has this to say: "My vote goes to those who are working for society where no one is forced into a predetermined role on account of sex." Or as one of my colleagues says, "Nobody should be discriminated against because of the shape of her skin." No one is forced into a predetermined role on account of sex. A society where men and women have the option to plan and pattern their lives as they themselves choose. This society will require many things: a new climate of opinion, which accepts the equality of the sexes while still recognizing human and biological differences. A society which provides daycare and supplementary home services, which makes choice possible. A society where non-merit factors in employment, such as sex, do not count. A society which provides a new concept of training for both young men and women, denied to employment. And social usefulness along with active parenthood. And most important, a society that provides a shortened workday and workweek with adequate pay for all workers, thus permitting time for families to be together, or father to participate in family activities, including the care and raising of children, where both parents can develop to their fullest as human beings. It's a long way down the road, says Esther Peterson, but it's coming. Abigail Adams, you recall, the able woman, another able woman as candid, perhaps as Betty Ford was recently, urged her present husband to have more concern for the ladies, and contended to him that all men would be tyrants if they could. Warren Farrell, who's been very closely associated with the women's movement, and working on the male side, we need people there to help change the men too. Warren Farrell says men have the ability to prevent women from seeking a whole range of alternatives, unless the women play the game by masculine rules. Men control hiring, firing, and jobs. They have the upper hand in choosing a mate, a career, the time and place of sex relations, where the family will live, and for how long they will stay. It's mainly the men who make the laws concerning abortion, marriage and divorce, adoption, inheritance, child custody, and birth control. Men control, in essence, women's freedom in relationship to men, and make laws even regarding her most personal possession, her own body. And women who enter a world of men, one previously reserved for men, find themselves tempted or coerced to adopt the so-called masculine values. It's oversimplified, but Farrell characterizes these contrasts somewhat in the following way, for at least the sort of majority group. The so-called masculine values, which values talking rather than listening, or I say telling rather than listening, logic rather than emotion, conflict and adventure rather than constructive and incremental growing, self-confidence rather than humility, quick decisiveness over thoughtful pondering, charisma and dynamism over long-term credibility, instrumental ends rather than human concerns, toughness rather than persuasiveness, external rewards rather than internal satisfactions, and sexuality rather than sensuality. Women, as has been mentioned, are looked to provide the services that help men perform. Jesse Bernard, well-known sociologist, phrases the situation thusly. Now it's necessary to abolish the conditions which tend to assign certain privileges, obligations, or rights to men. No decisive change in the distribution of functions and status as between the sexes can be achieved if the duties of the male in society are assumed a priori to be unaltered. The division of functions as between the sexes must be changed in such a way that both the man and the woman in the family are afforded the same practical opportunities of participating in both active parenthood and gainful employment. So my next comments, Dr. Grabner has already dealt with, and it's nice to have the interrelationships and continuity. Let me work around that a bit. The pattern of the life cycle has changed considerably for both men and women in the past 85 or 90 years. He's already indicated that in 1890, the average American woman had her last child, which was the fifth, usually, at the age of 32. And she and her husband survived for another 31 years together in joint marriage. In the 1960s, the average American woman, or as he said, 1970, had her last child at the age of 26, and this was about the third, somewhere, perhaps a little less. And she and her husband had joint survival for 41 more years. Thus, one-third of their married life was lived after the last child left home, and the woman had about half of her life left after the children entered high school. This is why I understand some of you women present are teachers. That's why I think it's so very important that we focus upon girls and young women, that they take the long look as to what they're going to do in those 35 years after their children, if they have them, do leave home, or do leave the home for most of the day for school. 90% of women will hold a job at some point in their lives. They hold jobs now longer than in former years, and they return to them sooner after childbearing, and at a younger age. Thus, how are modern women going to utilize their lives effectively when the birth rate is now at the lowest in our history, and they will have 35 more years to live following the entrance of the last child into school? This is something we need to very much stress to girls and young women, that long look. They need to prepare themselves. As I'll quote a little bit later, they can no longer expect to find practical usefulness for their lives merely in child raising or within the confines of four walls. The new roles that women are undertaking, as have been referred to, are a result of realistic and intelligent responses to changes out there in the real world. These do not constitute a fad, which are going to go away. Women are gaining equivalent educations, and now have more confidence in their competencies for politics, economics, and civic activities. Yet women remain relatively poor. All women, certainly more so black women and other minority women. They earn about one half as much income as men, and they have less than one half of other income in their lives, access to other income, for every level of society, regardless of class. 40% of the working women are single, divorced, or separated, and depend on their own earnings to support themselves and their families. And that's why the appeal of those who say a woman's place in the home and they don't worry about what they're paid or these legal rights ignore the fact that 40% of them are in these situations where they're earning their own way, and they do not have these other backstops. Since money means power, males remain strongly dominant still. Women have relatively fewer sources of income than men. For example, only 39% of the real estate, bonds, stocks, cash, notes, insurance, equities, and so forth are held by women, who are more than 50% of the population. And even this is overstated because some men put these things into the names of women for tax purposes. The chance to die a rich man is still much better than to be a dead rich woman. Now we need to recognize, maybe a quaint way of putting it, we need to recognize that most of us here are quite atypical. College graduates are only 7% of all American women over 25 years of age. Yet they've been given the most attention in research and social organizations and other matters. And we need very much, as you can point out, keep the vast majority in mind and be concerned about all women and all human rights. Women in the past have been rarely dependent upon men. Their conceptions of selfhood and marriage have led to such dependency. I'd like to share with you briefly some of the commentaries of Lynn Cain in her new little book, Widow, which some of you may have read. Just a couple of quotations. She said, Martin and I had never discussed money. Just one of those unliberated things, I suppose. Going back to the idea that little girls aren't good at math, a self-fulfilling prophecy that encourages financial incompetence. But the fact was, I never shared any of the real responsibilities of the household. My job? I was just running off to play. I ran the household just about the way a little girl plays house. I never even knew how much money Martin earned, or how much it took to run the household. She suggests that we all think of a contingency day as a concept, you know, what if? And for women, at least, what if you did not have a father, or a brother, or a husband, a man to depend on? Or, of course, men can very well and should consider what if they did not have a wife or a sister or mother, too, but in terms of economic and other circumstances, the dependencies tend to be women on men. She says, contingency day is an eminently reasonable concept. But so strong is a death taboo that some people with whom I discuss the idea find it shocking. Oh, I couldn't do that, one woman protested. I can't begin to imagine life without my husband. Well, I could not imagine my life without Martin, but he died, and here I am. The children and I would have been better off if I could have imagined life without him. I don't consider contingency day morbid or shocking in any way. It's a matter of love, of caring, of responsibility, of just plain common sense. So we were talking about young women preparing themselves for those a lifetime of their own development, and we were talking about married women. Promise still there. And if you've read Catherine Marshall's book about her life with Peter Marshall, recall that paragraph which she indicates her almost total ignorance of their financial affairs when he died. She didn't even know what insurance they had or where the policies were or anything of that sort. Jesse Bernard says, from very earliest years, girls will have to learn that however large marriage may loom in their lives, it is not a nirvana. It does not mark the end of their growth. Motherhood may be a relatively transient phase of their lives. They cannot indulge themselves by investing all their emotional and intellectual resources in their children. They cannot count on being supported all their lives simply because they are wives. And thus, I think we have to say that programs of continuing education for mature women are fine, but are certainly not enough.